Hey everyone, this is Cody from Unfortunate History.
And this is Greg.
And we just wanted to take a quick moment to let you know about our new merch store.
This is where you can find all the Unfortunate History merch you definitely don't need. We have got everything from hoodies to mugs to phone cases. And may I just say that I am particularly excited about the socks. Now, none of the profit for this will go into our own wallets. It goes straight back into the podcast to keep it independent and free.
And US and UK customers pay no shipping costs whatsoever.
All this can be found at shop.unfortunatehistory.com or on a link at unfortunatehistory.com. Again, shop.unfortunatehistory.com or a link at unfortunatehistory.com. Enjoy the show, guys.
And thank you so much for your support.
This is Unfortunate History.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to Unfortunate History. This is a podcast where we cover interesting, wacky, and unfortunate moments from history. My name is Cody Pennington, and with me today is Greg Skinner. How's it going, man?
I'm back. I'm back on the pod after a little hiatus again. Captain Unreliable is back.
Good to have you back. I'm sure everybody missed you.
Like I said, the last time this happened, I've got to give a big shout out to Sam for being the, you know, ever-present professional he is and jumping in last minute.
Yeah, you and Sam both are shouting each other out, it seems. Thank you so much, Sam, for jumping in on those last on that last series. Really awesome of you. I'm sure at some point in the future we'll have him back, or we'll just start a new podcast with him or something. Who knows? it seems like this whole podcast thing is just ever evolving. But how you doing, man? How are you?
I'm doing all right, man. I'm doing all right. Cracking on. It seems like the lockdown's slowly lifting and life's returning back to normal. Ever so slowly.
Seems like it. Very, very, very slowly, actually. Yeah.
Could it be a huge mistake from the government when wave two hits? Who knows? But the pubs are open and we can get pissed again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the world's been kind of crazy, you know? It keeps trying to beat me down with bills and love handles, but I'm not letting it, you know? I keep fighting every day.
I was a gym guy before this lockdown happened, and I put years into that, and all it took was 3 months for it all to go out the window.
That's fine.
It's just, when you said like fighting love handles, I'm battling love handles and man boobs.
Battling man boobs. Well, that kind of segues us right into today's topic, actually. This is not about fighting man boobs, but it is about fighting.
Okay.
And definitely about battling. Because today is going to have a lot to do with Australia and a war that was raged within its borders.
I didn't know what this episode was about, and now I know it's about Australia. There's going to be so many shit accents from me in this, and Cody cannot stop me this time.
I will not stop you this time, but I could edit you out if I felt the need.
See, last time you said this, I called your bluff and he won't do that. He did it, so.
Yep, I sure as hell did. If you guys want to hear the last crazy edit I did on Greg, go listen to the Digby Totham Water episode. Now, Australia has been known as the home of some of the world's most insanely dangerous animals known to man. You hear about giant great white sharks, crocodiles, giant spiders, and even terrifying koalas. Not to mention the fact that Australia is home to the most poisonous snake in the entire world. In fact, it's home to a ton of snakes, including, but not limited to, the black-headed python snake, the olive python snake, the Ola Nepali snake, the Boinga irregularis, the Cerberus rhynchops, the tree python, Enhydrus polylippus, the Stigonatus cucullatus, the keelback, common death adder, desert death adder, Demansia vestigiata, the spotted brown snake, green brown snake, western brown snake, eastern brown snake, king brown snake, Rhinoplacephalus polydecips, Pseudasuda, and of course, the Bandy Bandy.
I'm sure some of those were sexually transmitted diseases you just named.
I'm sure they were named after these deadly fucking snakes.
How is anyone alive in Australia?
I don't know. I have no idea.
It sounds like they're vastly outnumbered by the snake population. All they have to do is band together and think, we want to take Australia back, and the snakes will rise and they will win.
They will win, absolutely. Now, any of these previously mentioned animals can be seen as a real threat. However, there are few animals that have disrupted the ways of life in Australia more than the emu. In fact, emus caused so much trouble in Australia that the government decided to declare war on them in 1932. So today, we'll be looking into the Great Emu War of Australia to find out what happened, why it happened, and who actually won the war.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about this episode now. The Australian people better not have lost to the emus. I feel like emus aren't the smartest, if I'm being totally honest.
Well, we'll discuss that in a bit.
What do they have military tactics to? Is the emu battalion banded together to flank the Australians or some shit like that? Did they have their own umbrella-wielding general that led them into battle?
Well, we will discuss all of that in a moment.
Actually. Okay.
Now, our story begins just after the end of World War One in 1918. At this time in history, Australian veterans were beginning to return home from the war. However, they were returning home to nothing. Most of the soldiers, as is the case even today, led common lives working blue-collar jobs like farming prior to joining the war. Obviously, following the war, the government had no real use for these soldiers and had to demobilize them. However, the government needed to figure out what to do with these veterans. They had already begun paying them war pensions and giving them other financial assistance, but they had to figure out a way to help these veterans become more financially independent. To this end, the government decided to develop a soldier resettlement scheme.
It's quite funny because it feels like the Australian soldiers from World War One are literally treated better than most veterans of today by the government.
I suppose definitely in England. American soldiers, veterans, have access to a lot of stuff. As a veteran myself, I know that we had access to a lot of stuff in America. But I know that in England, they really, really don't.
you spat out the army like, go get the job.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the idea behind this resettlement scheme was to purchase large quantities of land and to allocate these lands to war veterans to use for farming. A lot of these lands were bought in the outback, you know, way out there in the middle of nowhere.
In the outback, mate. Yeah. Mate, got my Fosters. I feel like we should have had a can of Fosters for this. If it wasn't early afternoon, we could have symbolically had a can of Fosters.
Yeah, missed opportunity, that was.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, the purchase of this land was a huge undertaking. And throughout the scheme, the government purchased millions of acres to be allotted to the veterans that applied to receive them. Thousands of veterans were allotted these farms to cultivate wheat and raise sheep and other farm animals. However, it soon came to light that a large majority of the land was completely unusable, and the veterans were struggling to produce enough wheat to actually make a living.
But when you live in literally one of the driest, hottest places on the planet, the land isn't going to be great.
Yeah, like almost a literal desert. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Now, to make matters worse, soon following the resettlement scheme, the Great Depression hit in 1929. Because of this, wheat prices began to plummet. So, this land that the veterans had been given to grow wheat was not only not growing wheat, it was also producing wheat that was worth next to nothing. Because the veterans were now struggling, the government decided to assist them and offered them subsidies for the wheat if they grew more wheat. So the government would give them more money to offset their losses due to the depression if they produced more wheat.
They can't produce any fucking wheat.
Well, they basically told them to go out and produce as much as humanly possible and just continue to do so because the country needs wheat.
How, if the ground's not growing wheat, there's nothing you can really do about that.
It was growing wheat. It just wasn't growing a lot of wheat. And then obviously with the depression hitting, the prices plummeted. So the amount of wheat that they were producing wasn't enough to pay their bills, basically. So they were in a very hard position because they had been given these farms from the government who, I mean, you'd think they would have checked if the land was farmable, but, you know, I'm not sure. But either way, they were in a very bad predicament. And then the government decided to assist them by paying them subsidies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the farmers have still, to this day, not received a penny of those promised subsidies. None. However, if terrible land, empty promises, and a depression weren't enough, the soldier farmers were soon to meet their toughest enemy yet.
Those fucking emus, mate. Is that what it is? Is it the emus? Am I like totally wrong?
It could have been one of the thousands of snakes I mentioned earlier. Who knows?
Or literally any of the millions of insects that can kill you over there as
well. Yeah, exactly. Now, emus are only found in Australia, which I actually did not know. I thought they were found elsewhere, but they are literally indigenous to Australia. I must have been confusing them with ostriches or something.
An emu, it looks a lot like an ostrich, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. It looks similar, but I think ostriches are a lot taller.
So it's just a small ostrich. So it's a flightless bird with, like, a flesh neck. Could you not just boot it? We do not support animal cruelty at the podcast, but if you're faced by a fucking emu that's coming at you, don't be afraid to boot it.
Well, I'll tell you why they couldn't do that in a moment.
Okay.
Now, I won't go into all the quick facts about emus just yet. I'll give you, the listeners, some at the end of the episode. However, I will discuss information about them necessary to this story. Now, firstly, like Greg said, they are flightless birds, which many people likely know. They generally stand about 5'7".
Okay, that is still fucking really tall. So how tall is an ostrich then?
A male ostrich can grow to be 9.1 feet tall.
What the... Get him in the NBA? How is it that big? And I was never really particularly threatened by an ostrich in my life. I never saw them as like a scary animal, like a tiger or a crocodile. That's fucking changed now.
Yeah, you can ride them.
Oh, can't they run like 40 miles per hour or something like that? So probably not that fast, but they can run really
quick.
No,
I think they can, actually. I think they can.
That is mad. An ostrich would fuck me up. I think an emu would fuck me up. I'm only 2 inches taller than your standard emu, and they're the little ones.
Yeah. No, ostriches can run, can sprint at speeds of up to 45 miles an hour.
That is insane.
Now, the male emus weigh about 110 to 121 pounds, and females are said to weigh about 10 pounds heavier than the males. In terms of habitats, they must have daily access to fresh water and vegetation, normally, unless they're nesting. If they do not have access to food or water, they will travel and migrate for hundreds of miles until they find them. Now, the reason I bring up their migration is this. Before the cultivation of the farms for the veterans, emus were constrained to certain areas of Australia due to the lack of access to food and water. The inhospitable lands that the farms now occupied had previously been void of vegetation and water. However, when building these farms, the government also constructed artificial but permanent watering points for the farm animals. These watering points and the newly growing crops made for pretty tempting meals for the emus, who began stumbling upon the farms during their migration. Now, Greg, you asked earlier why they couldn't just boot them. Well, the emu's numbers began growing steadily, and by 1932, it said that 20,000 emus had migrated to the newly formed farmlands. And these emus then took to eating and destroying a large majority of the crops.
See, and in back into defense of when I said, why don't you just boot them, I had no idea that they were still 5'7", because I was under the impression that ostriches were about 5'7" to 6', and that these emus were maybe about 3' or something like that. A very, you know, voluble size of a bird. 5'7", you're not, no, I can't get my leg that high. I see why the war started, because I am turning and running from a 5'2". It's not the modern Velociraptor. This is what Velociraptors turned into. The genetics are still there somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm not fucking with an emu, and I'm definitely not fucking with an ostrich. I'm putting that out there now.
Yeah, but you can only imagine how difficult it was to beat 20,000 emus. I mean, that's like the size of army that they used at Helm's Deep.
I was just thinking that. Imagine that lining up.
Yeah, imagine like all of the orcs were actually just emus. Still as intimidating.
I'd say twice as fucking scary. I feel like orcs were more reasonable than an emu.
Yeah, you could talk to an orc.
You could talk to an emu, like, please stop, mercy. It's just going to peck you.
Now, up to this point in Australia, emus had been a protected native species. But with the havoc being brought on the veterans and their farms, they soon became known as pests. Soon, they were literally eating the veterans' livelihoods. The veterans started to worry that they would soon go bankrupt. Because of these worries, the farmers soon approached the government for further assistance with the issue. And at this point, I can only imagine that the government was pretty tired of hearing from these veteran farmers.
Yeah. Because
they've heard from them a lot. And then now they come to them saying 20,000 emus are destroying their crops. And they're like, God, these guys, can you please just handle it? Now, this is the importance of proper planning, people. Don't put farms where they don't belong. You don't put a farm on a mountainside, do you? Or I guess you do maybe rice paddy. You don't put a farm on Mount Everest, okay?
No.
Plan these farms out. Come on. This is good. This is taxpayers' money at waste, this is.
In their defense, I don't think they could have predicted that an army literally of emus would rock up at the front door and start eating everything. Like, I think if they had a list of things that could go wrong with this, I don't think emu crisis would even be on the list.
No.
Does an emu even have a natural predator? Or is it top of its food chain? I have a feeling it's top of its food chain.
I'm honestly not sure. I think I went to a restaurant that served emu burgers, though.
Yeah, fuck them. Fuck them. I've eaten ostrich as well. Fuck that ostrich, all 9 foot and that. Yeah. I'll eat it. They've got the brains, man.
Yeah. Now, a chosen group of the farmers were sent to meet with the then Minister of Defense, Sir George Pierce. In their meeting, the farmers and Pierce discussed their problems with the emus at length. The farmers, having served in World War I, thought it may be a good idea to kill the emus with machine guns and requested to have them issued to them. Now, Pierce did agree that the use of machine guns was probably a good idea. For some reason. I don't know why he agreed to that. But he then agreed to assist the farmers under three conditions. The machine guns must be used by military personnel, not the farmers.
But their former military personnel would...
They have to be active military personnel.
Okay.
Very strict in Australia with guns, obviously. They're not just going to hand them out to civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Another condition that Pierce wanted to have met is that the Western Australian government had to finance the troop transport. And then finally, the farmers had to provide food and accommodation to the soldiers as well as pay for the ammunition.
Mm.
The farmers agreed, and thus the Great Emu War was declared.
I feel like those terms are unreasonable, though, because they know the farmers are struggling for money and wheat. So it's like, yeah, you got to pay the soldiers in food and for the ammunition. He's like, but surely the farmers are like, well, we've got no fucking food or no fucking money because of our shit land and the emus that keep coming and destroying our crops. It's like a never-ending cycle of like things that can't be resolved.
Well, we'll bring that up towards the end of the story.
Okay.
We'll bring that up again. Now, some claim that this quote-unquote war was really just a publicity stunt by the Minister of Defense, particularly because at this time in Australian history, there was talk in Western Australia about seceding to form a separate country.
Hmm.
It's claimed that Sir George Pierce wanted to create a lot of publicity around this war to possibly highlight the Australian government assisting the Western Australians, possibly to convince the Western Australians that the Australian government was there to help them. However, we'll find out later that the publicity of the war somewhat backfired. And also, as a bit of further backstory, there was even a vote on secession within Western Australia after the Great Emu War, and almost 70% of the population voted to leave the Commonwealth of Australia. They actually wanted to go and start their own country. However, the establishment of Australia had actually been an act of the British Parliament.
Yep.
When the British Parliament were approached with this vote from Western Australia, they said that it was not something that they could act on since the Western Australians did not have the support of the Australian federal government. So this vote of secession was kind of just set aside.
Okay, then. That was kind of confusing for me. So who was in in separate parts of Australia? They had different leadership? Or
they have different states. So different sections. And Western Australia had its own government.
So it's kind of similar to the states then, really?
Kind of, yeah. I think, actually, if you're an Australian listener and you disagree, just get in touch with us at info@unfortunatehistory.com or on our social media.
And let us know if you've ever seen an emu in real life and tell us how scared were you on a scale of 1 to 10.
Yeah, please. Now, the Australian government spared no expense in assisting in the Great Emu War. To head the attacks, they sent Major G.P.W. Meredith, and under Meredith's command was a full fighting force of two men.
I wasn't expecting that. Two dudes, Barry and Nick.
Now, along with this incredible army, the government also sent two machine guns with 10,000 rounds of ammunition.
That's a number that makes sense to me, 10,000 rounds. Okay, reasonable. Two dudes, two machine guns, lots of bullets.
Well, since there were around 20,000 emus, I don't believe they planned on killing all of them unless they lined them up in front of each other. Either way, with this great force and the numerous weapons, the emus' days were numbered. I did think it was quite hilarious that they literally went to the government and said, help us. So they sent three people out and said, okay, yeah, we got this.
Fucking imagine that. They're like, yeah, you're going to fight 20,000 emus. Okay, who else we got? It's you and two other guys. Like, oh. Here's a gun. And it's like, how big is an emu again? 5'7". How tall am I? 5'7". Okay, we might be in a bit of trouble here.
Well, Australian military involvement was scheduled to begin in October 1932, but it rained. So the war was postponed until November 1932.
It's like, open the gun. Not today. It's been wet.
So the war was postponed until November 1932. Similar to a football game. On the 2nd November 1932, the war truly commenced, as by this point, I'm sure that the two riflemen were just foaming at the mouth for emu blood. Now, the army traveled to the town of Campion, where a group of 50 emus had been spotted. Unfortunately, the emus were out of range for the gunners, so some nearby settlers volunteered to assist in herding the emus toward Meredith and his men. However, the emus were cunning, and they were waiting for this moment. And instantly, all of them scattered in every direction. Confused at the scene, the riflemen fired at the birds. Out of the 50 emus, the men claimed to have killed, quote, a number of birds.
The same number of birds, it wasn't even an emu. They killed, like, a pigeon and a dove. Like, I was just thinking, when they said they were spotted in, like, a town, like, I had a vision of, like, hanging outside a bar with leather jackets and, like, a switchblade, smoking cigarettes, flicking a coin. Hey, you're looking at your fucking knock.
Well, later that same day, another flock was encountered. The men claimed that they killed, quote, perhaps a dozen at this battle.
How many bullets have they used so far out of their 10,000?
I'll let you know in a few moments. Now, Major Meredith had made a crucial mistake in this war. He had underestimated his opponent. So he and his men retired for the day to plan another attack. Now, on November 4th, 1932, the major planned an ambush on his feathered foes near a local dam. After setting this ambush, the men heard word that 1,000 emus were heading in their direction. This is it, Meredith thought to himself. This is when I prove to the world that I'm a man.
It's fucking emus.
Meredith was actually so confident with this planned ambush that they had only brought one of their machine guns with them.
What was the other two dudes going to do? Watch, like...
They soon caught sight of the giant flock. The emus, who could run up to 30 miles an hour, were speeding in their direction. Now, Meredith readied his men, and I can only assume both of the riflemen were holding the one gun at this point. Probably assisting each other with the chiefs. Hold, Meredith said. Both riflemen struggled to control their breathing. Hold! Sweat began to drip from the men's brow. Hold! The flock was just seconds away from being in range, and fire! Meredith finally yelled, and fire they did. The machine gun was fired into the flock of 1,000 birds for a couple of seconds, and then it jammed.
Fuck off!
Then all of the emus scattered away from the area. The men killed 12 emus. There were no more seen that day.
12 emus. So how many is this altogether? Like 15 emus out of 20,000. The side that the human brain is smarter, like it's more powerful than the most powerful supercomputer around today, and we can't defeat emus.
Yeah. Yeah. Now let me just say that obviously the previous part of the story was embellished with impeccable writing. It very likely didn't actually happen that way, but the gun did jam and only 12 birds were killed. Now, the following few days, Major Meredith decided that they should try to go further south, where the birds were reportedly, quote, fairly tame. Although, this also turned out to be a complete failure. Now, this next bit of information is not embellishment, but actually a quote. And you asked if they started using military tactics, or if they started fighting back.
Yeah.
Well, by the fourth day of the war, it was observed that, quote, each pack seems to have its own leader now.
No, they don't. The fucking emus. Their brains are the size of peanuts. They don't have leaders.
No, wait. This is still part of the quote. A big black plumed bird, which stands fully 6 feet high and keeps watch while his mates carry out their work of destruction and warns them of our approach. So effectively, the emus were starting to fight back.
Fucking emus. I can't get over this. It's because the emu. I found emus and ostriches funny anyway.
Yeah. Well, with the emus evolving.
Evolving.
Meredith had to evolve as well. He decided that they couldn't wait for the emus to come to them anymore. He would have to take the fight to their homes and their schools and their cities. And since the emus always ran away when they were attacked, it was thought that mounting one of the machine guns to the top of a truck would be a great idea. However, unfortunately, this was dumb. As I said a moment ago, emus can run up to 30 miles an hour. And a truck going 30 miles an hour in the outback is not going to be a smooth ride. In fact, it was so bumpy that the men couldn't kill a single bird.
Are they fucking stormtroopers or something? How are they so shit at shooting?
Well, 6 days after the beginning of the war, 2,500 rounds of ammunition had been used. The number of emus killed was uncertain, although the men were tasked with killing at least 100 birds and returning with their skins. So you'd think that they would have at least kept track of the number of birds. But there's no real record of it. The number is somewhere between 50 and 500, but the latter, the 500 number, is given from settlers. The 50 is more likely, and I would actually argue that it was probably even less. Luckily for the men, they had suffered no casualties, which Major Meredith had actually listed in his official report on the war.
No, because you fucking emus, man.
We lost none of our two men. Now, this next bit is pretty funny to me. An ornithologist by the name of Dominic Severanty commented on the Great Emu War, saying, quote, "The machine gunner's dream of point-blank firing into serried masses of emus were soon dissipated. The emu command had evidently ordered guerrilla tactics.
Emu command."
"And its unwieldy army soon split up into innumerable small units that made use of the military equipment uneconomic. A crestfallen field force therefore withdrew from the combat area after about a month."
I can't get over emu command. There's no emu command.
Well, after the failure of these battles, the war began receiving negative press coverage in the local media, with some papers claiming the emus were too fast for the soldiers and that, quote, only a few had been killed. And because of this, the Australian House of Representatives discussed the operation, and eventually the Minister of Defense decided to withdraw the military personnel and the guns on November 8th. As the emus were still numbering around 19 to 20,000, it's fairly safe to say that they won the war.
Big time.
Yeah.
Didn't even come. Yeah, in all fairness, when you first told me this, I actually had an impression that like there would be a full-on army of men fighting these emus. And I was like, no way did they lose. But in fairness, three dudes with two guns against 20,000 emu. Like, I don't know what's happened more, if I've gained respect for emus or lost respect for Australians. I'm sorry, Australian listeners, you should be able to handle a few emu. 20,000.
I don't know, man. That seems like a very formidable army, 20,000 emus against three guys. I can imagine that as a cover of a movie or like a poster for a movie, just three guys holding guns and then 20,000 emus stampeding towards them. Well, actually, there was a second attempt at this war. Now, only a few days after the withdrawal of the army of three, the farmers were begging for more government assistance. The emu invasions were not getting any better. In fact, it seems like they were pretty pissed off with the farmers because of the war. The situation was so bad that the Premier of Australia supported military re-involvement. And the Australian government decided to go for a second attempt at the Great Emu War. They offered the guns to the Western Australian government if they could provide the necessary people. However, they couldn't. There was nobody in Western Australia that could do these guns. Now, I'm sure you can imagine at this point that the disgraced Major Meredith was sulking in a pint of Foster's, blitzed out of his mind in some random bar because he had just lost a war against emus. I can guarantee he was. Well, since the necessary men could not be found by the Western Australians, the Australian government needed someone with experience, someone who had seen the horrors of those great birds. So, who else but Meredith?
They pulled him back in.
He's like, no, I can't go.
But he might have been the opposite. He's like, yeah, I'm going to get those fuckers this time. I will bring my reputation back. Even if he won now, his reputation is tarnished forever.
He lost the first battle, or at least the first attempt at the war. I mean, come on. It was pretty bad, pretty abysmal.
Like, to be fair, if you actually look at it, it's probably a much more challenging task than I'm giving it credit.
Yeah, of course.
It is 20,000 large birds, like, you know what I mean? But
yeah.
But still, when you just listen to it, you're like, it's birds. They're fucking birds. They can't even fly. They can't fly.
You know? It is ridiculous. And it is the government's fault for building these farms. They didn't you know, maybe if they would have done a bit more, I guess, research into the areas, but it was also, you know, just after the World War One, so maybe they just didn't think about it back then, the migration patterns of certain animals, but they would have just thought of that. They could have avoided all this.
So I presume what these three guys they gave them, probably in the military, they probably fought in World War One. They survived the Germans.
Yeah.
And yet they couldn't beat the emus. Like, yeah. They probably come back thinking, oh, that was the worst thing of my life. I can't believe I got through that. Yeah. Oh, you got to go fight some emus now. I'm like, oh, this is more my, you know, line of work. This will be easy. Nope. Emu PTSD.
Now, the second attempt at the war was actually much more successful than the first, relatively. In fact, over the course of about a month, Meredith claims that his men killed 986 emus with the use of 9,860 rounds, effectively killing one emu for every 10-round shot. He also claimed that 2,500 of the birds died from their injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Although this still barely put a dent in the emu population, it was claimed that the second attempt at the war had at least saved a bit of the wheat. But at what cost? You know?
What a cast. It's like that bit in Avengers fan. It's like, what did it cost? Everything. Like, just, as he stares into the distance. Like.
That's just Meredith with his Fosters. Everything. Now, following the conclusion of the Great Emu War, the farmers actually continued having trouble with the emus. They requested government assistance multiple times, but each time they were rejected. I think the government was pretty much done at this point. But the government did, however, put a bounty system in place for the killing of the emus, which helped a bit. A lot of people went out and killed these emus and claimed the bounties.
Probably makes a lot of sense, but I bet they racked up a lot of money. Like,
yeah,
that's probably a way bigger like incentive. Just let the martial law take place and just put money on the head of emus.
Yeah.
And there are people who go like, yeah, just get an axe and just hack down an emu.
Yeah, even the farmers, obviously. Now, the Great Emu War was criticized by some animal rights activists. It was claimed that the war was actually less of a culling of the population and more of an extermination of the birds. They believed that the aim of the war was the total destruction of the emus. Luckily, the birds were pretty much bulletproof. Finally, the use of pest exclusion fencing started becoming a popular defense to the emus, which makes me wonder why the farmers didn't just look at this option to begin with. But who am I to judge? Why would a farmer not put up a fence, you know?
A fence is like, not even keeping emus out of fence is just so much more convenient than sending out people with guns to try and kill. Because it's not even emus that are going to get in. There's so much stuff that can fuck you up in Australia. Look, you should have this up anyway.
Well, I should clarify that statement by saying that they did have a type of fencing, but the emus would create holes in this fencing, which would allow other varmints and critters to get through these holes and destroy the crops more. But they started replacing that fencing with more protective pest control fencing, which, like I said, probably should have done that to fucking begin with. I mean, why bring in the military to handle this problem?
Well, you go fence first, and if that fails, that's when you step it up.
Exactly.
I feel like there's about 7 steps you could take before getting the military involved.
Yeah. Well, either way, I feel pretty confident in saying that the Australians did lose the Great Emu War.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose we can say that is pretty unfortunate.
It is pretty unfortunate. It's pretty fucking funny as well.
Yeah, it's very funny.
I've had a good time with this episode. Yeah. I knew when you said the name, I thought, I'm going to like this one.
Yeah. Now, let me hit you with some quick emu facts. To communicate, male emus sometimes make calls, which sound like emu, and can be heard over long distances. Females make resonant booming sounds. Now, before they mate, the female makes dull, rattling, drum-like sounds, and the male actually builds the nest in his territory, where the female will later join him. And these nests actually hold 15 to 25 eggs, which actually come from several hens. So, different mothers.
So, he's actually like creating like his own bachelor pad and just come on round to my place. Emu.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the males actually incubate the eggs. And during the incubation, which lasts 56 days, the male doesn't eat, drink, or defecate. Obviously, he has to stock up on his food and that sort of stuff, but he does not move for 56 days, including eating, drinking, or defecating.
Jesus Christ, it must be so uncomfortable. Like,
yeah.
A combination of just being really hungry, having a massive dry mouth, and absolutely caning for a shit. Yeah. Like, they're like the three basic things that are just not comfortable for a person. But yet the emu doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah. Now, once the male starts sitting, most females leave the territory, sometimes pairing with other males and laying further clutches, like little sluts.
Slags. Fucking slags. Leaving the bloke there just watching it happen, like, oh.
and he can't move. Yeah. For 56 days, he's like, oh, man, wait a minute.
Barbara, I love you, like, but I can't sit up.
However, a few females do stay behind to defend the male on the nest, using their loud, booming calls to ward off predators. Now, males are aggressive when the chicks hatch, and then they drive off the remaining females and attack anything else that approaches the nest. Newly hatched chicks weigh about 5.5 to 7.6 ounces. The male stays with the chicks for about 5 to 7 months. Lost chicks are allowed to join other broods as long as they are not bigger than the male's offspring. The male may then mate for the next season's nesting, and then at 2 or 3 years of age, the young are fully mature and capable of reproduction. The emu lives 5 to 10 years or longer in human care. And a lot of that 5 to 10 years is just full of emu, sex, and then a lot of sitting.
And not forgetting the seething rage and destruction of crops and war waging, warmongering fucking evilness that is the emu.
Yeah, all the blood. There's so much blood.
Again, having got these soldiers, you know, you get like the Vietnam flashbacks that people have, where it's just like the distant stare and they see helicopters going off while Creedence Clearwater plays.
Yeah.
It's that, but with emus. Like, okay.
Yeah. Now, thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Greg, I hope you enjoyed it as well.
I did, man. It was a really good episode. I did have a good chuckle at this and about the emus.
Yeah.
I have a newfound respect for emus.
Yeah, the formidable emu.
Mm-hmm.
It was good to step away from the more serious stuff that we did with Captain Morgan last week and the week before. If you guys want to check that series out, please feel free to do that. If you'd like to follow the show, just go to unfortunatehistory.com. All of our links are there. Also, we mentioned at the beginning of the episode in a little ad about our merch shop. So please check out our merch shop. All of the orders to the US and the UK are free shipping. And actually, any orders worldwide over $60 are free shipping as well.
Mm-hmm.
Feel free to check that out, please. If you want to follow me, just follow me at codypennington.com. If you want to follow Greg...
Well, you can follow me on... Facebook, just search Greg Skinner, and I've actually just set a new Instagram handle, and it is Flight of the Emu.
Yes.
You can find me on Instagram at Flight of the
Hell
Emu.
Yeah.
No more G-Skin93. And I know emus don't fly, but that's the charm of it.
That is the charm of
it. Find me at Flight of the Emu.
Yeah. Well, we'd also like to end this episode with a special treat. A friend of mine is engaged to someone who works as a piano bar entertainer on cruise ships. His name is Rowan Wendell. He is actually an Aussie himself, and he wrote a song about the Great Emu War that we're going to play for you now. If you'd like to follow Rowan, just go to facebook.com/Rowan Wendell Comedy or search Rowan Wendell on Facebook, and his page should just pop up. And Rowan is spelled R-O-H-A-N, not R-O-W-A-N or O-N or whatever. It's R-O-H-A-N, Wendell, W-I-N-D-L-E. Thank you guys so much for listening, but unfortunately, we gotta go. So stay unfortunate.
Stay unfortunate.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, I want to try out a new song. This one's a war tune, but unlike the songs about Gallipoli and France, the enemy in this war wasn't even human. And since we're still bitter about losing... I'm not going to give them the honour of even saying their names. Here we go. It was 1932 when crops were ruined by roaming herds of destructive dinosaur descendants, brazen big-necked birds. So listen to my story about the enemy with big toes, about the West Australian War, lost to flightless feathered foes. With memories of Flanders Fields still vivid in their chest, and Major Meredith in command, our army headed west. McMurray and O'Halloran as mankind's mercenaries, just soldiers and machine guns against avian adversaries. Into battle went our boys, 5 foot foul fighters fled. Their claw-toed black plume captains, abandoning their dead. But our nemesis were too numerous, impossible to defeat. Guerrilla units, swift and strong, and nimble on their feet. Outclassed by cruel, colossal crows, the human army fails. With ornithological opponents whopping weak-winged willy wagtails, our soldiers packed their weapons, although it seemed absurd. They went home having lost the war against a flightless bird. So avoid Australian ostriches, leave desert doves on their own. Retreat from rapid running roosters, leave overachieving chickens alone. Beware of beginning battles with guardians of green eggs, pernicious pole-necked pigeons, hat decorations on legs,